Yeah, I was having lunch at the hotel, and a guy came up to me at lunch this Saturday and asked if I would join them for lunch. Now, maybe he was planted there by the regime, you know, so, because, but maybe he was just a guy who had a regional bank and his bank director is in from Dubai.
Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, has a plan to transform not just the Saudi economy, but the Saudi society. And I don't need to tell you, given your experience, how ambitious that plan is.
First of all, he's an amazing young man.
And not the fact that you've got this massive upsurge within Saudi society for a change, that he is both leading it and reflecting it, you know.
I am just back from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where I spent the last week. I witnessed what seems like the beginning of a revolution happening there. I was honored to interview the future king of Saudi Arabia, His Royal Highness Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, on stage at the kingdom's Future Investment Initiative Conference. During our interview, His Royal Highness sent a message to the Saudi people and the world that he is leading a new vision in Saudi while being interviewed by me, a symbol of freedom in my jacket and pants, not covered up. The country was buzzing about his remarks.
Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman isn't waiting for his turn at the throne to take his country in a radically different direction. The 32-year-old prince is distancing himself from hardline Islam, progressing women's rights, and looking past oil for income.
Yes, he's so smart, he's so bright. He's so focused.
The greatest sin, there are two great sins in journalism. One is to say anything sort of possibly positive or optimistic, you know, in one of these things. So when someone like me comes along and does that, I mean, holy hell comes down on you.
And his youth came at an amazing time in the world, and all the stars aligned for him.
There are two great sins in journalism. One is to say anything sort of possibly positive or optimistic.
But you are having radical ideas, some might say. Recently, you've announced that you will soon allow women to drive. You are allowing foreign investment in your beautiful country. Why now? What triggered this change in thinking?
Two of the sons of the King of Saudi Arabia, the Emir Faisal and the Emir Khalid, are on a visit to this country. The princes who have recently been in America are conducted around coastal defense centers at Dover. The royal guests are assured of a warm welcome here. And as is the usual practice, we invite them to inspect our frontline towns, the renown of which is spoken of with admiration in Arabia.
I'll tell you, I think we'll all invest here. I think today was a great tribute to the fact that if you walk through the halls of this hotel, you think you're in New York City.
An 18-room mansion in Palm Beach becomes a convalescent home for King Saud of Saudi Arabia, who is recuperating from recent surgery. President Kennedy pays a courtesy call on the leader of the oil-rich country to wish him a speedy recovery. Princess Dalal steals the show, but this is nothing new for the president, whose daughter Carolyn is also quite adept at doing the same.
Your love belongs to me. At night when you're asleep, into your tent I'll creep, and the stars that shine above will light our way to love. You'll rule this land with me, the Sheikh of Arabi.
The following Alternative Views program was recorded in June of 1980.
This is Gayatri Spivak.
She lived in Saudi Arabia for a year, teaching school. She can tell us what it's like. How did Saudi Arabia get that way? What about the controversial movie, The Death of a Princess? Gayatri Spivak can tell us all about this, her experiences, and her insights tonight on Alternative Views News Magazine. Although the Gulf War has focused attention on the Arab states, particularly in the Arabian Peninsula, the establishment media have given us very little background on those countries, particularly of the main ally, Saudi Arabia.
Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. Tonight we're going to have a special program, Inside Saudi Arabia. Our guest is Professor Gayatri Spivak of the English Department, who spent several weeks in Saudi Arabia lecturing at the university and talking to people in that country. Gayatri, I discovered in reading Life magazine, a special issue they had on Saudi Arabia, that up until about the late 1940s, only 100 non-Muslim visitors had even visited Saudi Arabia, that it was simply off limits. They wouldn't give visas to non-Muslim people, with few exceptions. And the pictures that they had in this Life magazine indicated a very sort of backward country with no modernization at all. How did it appear to you? Were there many non-Western people, or many Western people in now? What were the signs of modernization?
There were many Western people. I was in an international hotel, quote unquote, and the lobbies were just full of Japanese, English, American, with their briefcases. And if you listened in on the conversations, they were talking about deals and so on in all areas of economic endeavor. And what it reminded me of most strongly was Dhaka, Bangladesh, just after 1971. The country had opened up, and I was in a hotel in Dhaka, and the lobby was full of Japanese, Americans, English, all having these kinds of conversations. But in Saudi Arabia, there was a real difference. No women. Perhaps one or two on the Western women on the arms of Western men, but otherwise no women at all. Certainly not a woman alone. I felt very odd. As for general signs of modernization, it was absolutely weird. You know, I went into Saudi Arabia expecting to see a little desert, camels, and so on and so forth. I go up to the top floor of this grand hotel. I look out of the window, and it's 2 o'clock in the morning. There's a kind of glow. You see a sort of very sand-colored landscape, but every building is new.
When was this, by the way?
This was in March of this year.
Oh.
In March of this year. Every building, I don't mean brand new, but I mean modern. And looks brand new, in fact.
So it's a country that's undergone rapid, very recent modernization. What are the signs of tradition that still strike one?
Well, actually, of course, right from the first day, I kept saying, I want to see a little bit of old Riyadh. And in fact, I saw more of old Riyadh in the pages of your Life magazine than I did in Riyadh itself. The people kept on saying, look, it's all gone. I mean, this is a new place. So I was taken near the souk one day, and the local traditional market, and I saw a few of those lanes with the mud buildings, etc., etc., and they were beautiful, like all poor, backward things are, quote, quaint and beautiful. Mm. But that was just a little area of the town, which sort of one says is old Riyadh, and people still live there, but by and large, it's enormous new buildings, wide new roads, and then vacant lots where you see shacks, where people live also. That's what it looks like.
Were you able to go to other cities, other towns, and to contrast Riyadh with that?
No, I went to, you see, I had this job at the University of Riyadh, and they worked me very hard, which I sort of liked. So there was really no time to contrast it with anything. I wanted very much to go to Mecca. And it was then that I found out that I couldn't go because I wasn't a Muslim. So that was impossible. I went to Dharan to catch my flight back, but that was at night, so I didn't see much. But I think Jidda probably has a little more of, you know, what we would call like a longer sign of modernization, whereas Riyadh is really brand new since 1973 almost.
But aren't there also deeply conservative tendencies towards traditionalism there that cause quite striking contradictions? For instance, the situation of women. Aren't they still, in a sense, living in the Middle Ages? Aren't there strong Muslim customs that regulate the behavior of women? How does this appear to one?
I think it's there's a contradiction between tradition and modernity in the women as well. Now, mind you, there was absolutely no possibility for me. I led a very restricted life. I don't believe, although I am from India myself and had my education in India, my early education, graduate education, I have never felt so restricted in my life at all. I was not free to contact people or to make a telephone call, go see someone myself. So I only saw the women who were capable of, who belonged to families that could send them to a school. I did see some so-called lower class women who were the servants at the princess's party that I went to. But by and large, in the women that I met, there was this, what you're calling medieval lifestyle and degrees of acceptance and rebellion, but their minds were by no means what you would call medieval by a long stretch of the imagination. And that contradiction was much more startling to me than the, even though I know I am an Indian and Indian women are my relatives, I know Indian women all across the caste class line, even so I was surprised by the coexistence in these women of the conflict between tradition and modernity, and also in men, because men took the restrictions that were imposed upon them by the obligation to treat women in this way as if they were self-evident, as if they were natural. So that the victimization by ideology was on both sides and coexisted well with open-mindedness in other areas, ability to understand things, ability to talk to me. And just one final thing, the contrast between tradition and modernity is seen very strongly when you talk to men or to women and you see them wearing clothes that are obviously uncomfortable for them, and the traditional clothes that are now required of Saudi men and traditional clothes that Saudi women never really have given up. You don't see this in countries where traditional clothes are worn by choice. You know, there was a certain kind of discomfort in the well-educated Saudi male because he was obliged to wear all of those.
And the women also, even in the university, are obliged to wear the veil. It's obligatory, even among more modern educated women at the university. Is that true?
Well, since the university is not open to women, you see, where I was teaching, it was it's called the Center for Girls, funnily enough. Now, that's only for women, you see.
I see.
So they enter, and there are male officials sitting in the foyer and then in the first floor, and then you go up into the university itself, and you never see men again. So they enter veiled. And, you know, the veil is not the way you saw it in The Death of a Princess. The veil is more like a little black piece of cloth that makes your head look like a coconut. You know, it's not those flowing sort of veils that give you a certain air of mystery and so on. This was really a very sad thing to see a young woman who was wearing a long skirt and a blouse upstairs, walking down the stairs to get into her chauffeur-driven car, and having had her in class, I know she's quite bright. All of a sudden, she wraps her head up like a coconut, and then she's feeling her way down the stairs and then getting into her car. It's very bizarre.
So in class with women, they can unveil themselves for a brief period.
They're without veils inside the school.
That's so different from Morocco, where I lived, and in Turkey. In Turkey, of course, the veil is outlawed now, although a lot of the women, particularly in the countryside or small towns, still wear the jellaba, you know, the hood, the long black robe. But in Morocco, there were a lot of changes just in the 2.5 years I was there. But the use of the veil was quite different. People would walk in the streets, and if they would sit down at a cafe or something, or on the sidewalk, they would take down their veil. Or if they would get onto a bus, frequently they would take down their veil, sit on the bus and chat, and then when they would get off the bus, they would put their veil back on, and then they would leave. Or if a girl may go to work in Western dress, except she would have the jellaba and veil over it, and then when she got to work, she would take it off. Or down at the beach, you'd see girls go down to the beach with the jellaba, long jellaba, and the veil on, go down to the beach, whip it off, and there's a bikini. And they'd play around in their bikini for the afternoon and put the jellaba and veil on and go home. Yes. And it was, even the way they wore it was differently. Some of them would wear them way up here on the top, so all you'd see was just a crack. And some of them would wear them at the tip of the nose. Some of them would wear them down, covering the mouth. Some of them would just drape them like slingshots around there. So there was quite a bit of difference, but I guess in Saudi Arabia, that everything is much more rigid then.
Only for Saudi women. You see, for Muslim women in general, and of course many of the students were not Saudi women because all of the, not just the Arab world, but the Muslim world in general, people have come to make money in Saudi Arabia. And then, of course, as you were asking me, were there Western people? Then you have... well, I can't call a Japanese a Western person, but I mean there were the representatives of the advanced capitalist countries also making money in another way. But the other Arab or Muslim women were not obliged to cover their faces. See, they wore a sort of free floating veil. They could show their faces. It is only the Saudi women. And then I was obliged, even American women teaching there were obliged, to cover arms down to the wrist and legs down to the ankle.
So no flesh hardly could be.
No flesh, but the Saudi women. But I didn't have to cover my head or my face, so it was okay. I didn't wear the teep usually because that marks me out as a Hindu. You know, I don't know that it would have been bad because after all, a white person is marked out as a Christian also or a Jew. But well, no, there are no Jews there. But at any rate, I didn't wear a teep because there are Pakistani and Bangladeshi Muslims who wear saris, of course, and there were sari-wearing women, some, very few.
Gayatri, could you say a few words about the structure of the university? You seem to indicate that women are segregated from men. How do they study there? What sorts of things do they study? Are there men teachers at all in the university that you taught at, or is it all women?
It's all women. I have a special interest in thinking about the structure of the university because just before I left, I read an exchange of letters in the Chronicle of Higher Education precisely on the question of the position of women in the Saudi Arabian university situation. And it was a young American woman who had gone there to teach who was complaining that she had not been told what the situation was really like. And I think there was some truth in that. On the other hand, having been there teaching the woman students, I myself would like to go back, precisely because there is a kind of segregation that people on the inside are trying to combat. In a country where religious power and political power are identified, and you have a dynastic monarchy, it's very difficult for people who want, you know, academics who want change to happen, suddenly to become martyrs, you know, and make those changes. I can quite see the necessity for some, although I myself feel that people like me should talk about that necessity so that the situation is understood, the necessity for some prevarication in order to get good teachers from abroad. But once you get there, you have to suffer hardship. There's no doubt about that at all. But if you are prepared to make some sacrifices, important sacrifices, in your lifestyle, which will be temporary, And if you're prepared to confront these women and to work in the publicization of the genuine impulse among many of the teachers, not all, some, let's say, of the male teachers, in changing this sort of situation, I think the teacher from abroad can really be very helpful indeed. There are sacrifices involved like this. And these were mentioned in the exchange in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Or there are female deans, there's a female structure of control, female chairpersons of departments and so on. But then there is, all of these people are under the exact same structure on the male faculty, so that every decision that's made in-house can be totally vetoed by the male faculty. Examinations which are graded by woman teachers, women's exams, can be regraded by male faculty. If there are visiting male faculty who are teaching a class, they are seen on closed-circuit television by the women, because men and women can't see each other. I asked if I could address the male students, and I was quite prepared to cover my face, and I was told no. In fact, my host was extremely daring in allowing me to address the male faculty in a kind of faculty development seminar. That's another bag of beans.
In person or by
in TV? Person, oh. In person. But I couldn't address the male students. So I asked him, look, why can't I teach the male students? As I say, I will cover my head, and I'm not a Muslim. And he said, he was a good man. He said quite openly, here it's not a question of sex, it's a question of power. A woman does not teach men. You see?
So the structures of male domination in the family and in the society at large are reproduced in the university.
Indeed.
How do the women take to this? Are they looking for something different? Are they a fertile source for accepting change?
They are and they aren't. You see, once again, every generalization I make should be understood in terms of the kind of woman that I was allowed to meet. Generally speaking, the wives of professors would launch apologetics for the situation and show how, in fact, this was more democratic, how it gave the woman more, you know, all of those old chestnuts, it gave the woman more power because it was in the home. You know, the man might have power, but once he gets home, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the young ones, the students, I felt had a real impulse toward change. They sought me out again and again outside of class. In fact, I received letters from them maybe at the rate of twice a week. And they really, they knew about what was going on outside. They were bright girls, and they certainly wanted change. On the other hand, they were deeply religious, nearly all of them. I think I encountered one woman who had refused to take the obligatory Islamic culture courses, and therefore year after year she was not graduating. But otherwise, everyone else was. I was told that there was another person, another student who was like this, but she was out of the country then, so I was not able to encounter her. But their take on the religious situation is also a predictable one, and I think we have seen in the history of many countries real change coming out of this take on religion, which is true Islam does not require this sort of suppression. I never questioned this belief at all, because I was there for a very short time, and I think this can be a positive, productive, change-making kind of belief.
In other words, Islam itself can be used against the more conservative forms that it takes in Saudi Arabia to criticize it.
If, yes, yes.
Actually, true, pure Islam is a very egalitarian form of structure.
Don't know what true Islam is really like.
I mean, just from reading about the Quran and the early history of the development of Islam, and then also seeing the movie, the documentary, The Death of a Princess, where they make this point, where there was not this condition of women until the Turks took over about, 400, 600 years ago, and forced this upon the Arab culture, and they've accepted it to...
Yeah, the Turks forced the veil on the other Islamic nations.
This doesn't mean that Muhammad and Islam put women on an equal basis because they had...
Well, they were contradictory here. I've seen conflicting passages in the Quran that would indicate that women are equal to men and have equal rights, and then others that say that women are the property of men, they're inferior to men, etc. And depending on the regime and the person, the teacher involved, they can teach either kind, an egalitarian or a sort of sexist form of Islam. On the whole, would you say that Saudi Arabia has a particularly conservative version of Islam that has been institutionalized, that on the whole, religion is a fairly conservative force, whereas it's contradictory, for instance, in Iran?
I have a rather complex set of takes on that situation, and I'm going to try and see if I can articulate them. First of all, this, as I was telling you the other day, after we saw the movie, this particular line of argument that the true religion is fine and is egalitarian or whatever, and that a kind of colonization imposed all of the problems, this is a line which you can encounter in many countries when a criticism is made. I say this because I've seen it happen again and again in India. You know, that true Hinduism is egalitarian, and the names of great women are trotted out, and then it was the Muslim occupation, no Turks there, you see, it was the Muslim occupation that brought in the caste system, in that really sort of solidified the caste system into the oppressive business, etc. So you see, when one hears this kind of an argument, the question that I would ask is not, is the argument true, but what ideology is producing this argument? If it's being produced in the interest of reform, and people are saying, well, let's go back to the true egalitarian religion, that's fine, I'll buy that argument. On the other hand, if it's being used so that any criticism can be delayed or can be sidetracked, saying, you know, you just don't understand the real meaning of our philosophy, you're racists, then I would say it's being used badly. So that's one take on that situation. And another take, which is, again, I'm not an Islamic historian or anything of that sort, but it seems to me that the version of Islam that obtains in Saudi Arabia, if one looks at the history books that I have read, for example, was a kind of a desert Islam, a kind of puritanical reform movement launched toward the end of the last century, as far as I know, my date could be wrong, by the Wahhabis. That's not, in fact, a Quranic Islam in that sense. The Wahhabi movement, out of which came Ibn Saud, is a latter-day movement which wanted Islam to become fundamentalist, so that what is being conserved is not necessarily some kind of historically pure origin, so that one could think of the Anabaptists, let's say, and the Christianity of the Church Fathers. That's not pure. I mean, where does a pure religion hang out would then be the question. And then finally, what's being done now, to an extent, is this well-known fact is being rewritten, you know, the way history is rewritten. And I was told by a colleague, a Saudi colleague, while I was there, that just 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was a man, a Saudi person, who gave a lecture in front of the history faculty at the university and suggested a kind of unbroken genealogy, you know, from the origins of Islam to the Islamic mores in Saudi Arabia, and was applauded. Mm-hmm. Everyone knew in that room, because they were learned men,
it was false.
That it was, you know, false, but there it was.
The story that I had was that Saud, who the country is named after, was a victorious warrior who started around 1907 consolidating his rule by attacking Riyadh with 10 of his followers and assassinating the Bedouin monarch, and then in the next 20 years defeating one after the other of the regions, in which he imposed a more conservative version of Islam, that it was populated by a lot of thieves and a lot of nomadic tribes that had a variety of customs. And he sort of homogenized the country with a more conservative brand of Islam that followed, for instance, the legal customs, stoning women for adultery, cutting off the hands of thieves, in a very sort of rigorous way that wasn't the case in previous forms of government or culture in the what was formerly just Arabia.
You see, what we tend to forget, and I want to say something else about consolidation after I say this, because that it's an argument close to my heart. What we tend to forget sometimes is that, after all, Islamic culture is one of the greatest cultures in the world. I mean, much of the grandeur of the European Renaissance, the subtext is Islamic, the great translators, all of that stuff. So that now what's happening is, in a peculiar kind of recuperative movement, as you say, a kind of the puritanical ardor of the Wahhabi tribal movement is co-opting for itself, by identifying itself with Islam, all of that extraordinary grandeur, as well as a sort of religious authority. And it's very peculiar to watch, to see. And again, I see this in terms of India as well. You know, people claiming the great spiritual heritage of India, people who really
and use it to legitimate political power.
Precisely so.
And the status quo.
Precisely so. And then the other thing that I was going to say, you brought up Saud consolidating the government. As a woman, I think the consolidation that seems most striking is the fact that he had 43 legitimate sons, and many illegitimate sons, and uncounted numbers of daughters. And the first son, I think, was born in 1902, and I think the last one in 1948. Now, if you do that, you have a ready-made dynasty. Can you imagine?
And they're the ones that own all this oil.
Of course.
If you can believe this Life magazine story, he had literally hundreds of concubine wives. He, according to Islamic law, you're only allowed four official wives at one time, but he would constantly divorce and marry new wives, and he would also have illegitimate wives, concubines, which sometimes ranged in the hundreds. And therefore, you're right, he established this dynasty that is the power structure of Iran. Is this the one and only royal family when we hear about the princesses and the sheikhs, etc.? It is literally his family and his alone that owns all this oil.
That's it. One man and his use of women.
Well, now, if he came in and conquered the Arabian Peninsula, does that mean that he absolutely obliterated all the people, or have they been assimilated into this area peacefully, or does that mean that there's a residue of a lot of potential revolution and revolt still there?
As far as I know, and again, I'm not a specialist in Islamic history, as far as I know, there was not a brutal extermination of the others. There weren't too many people anywhere. I mean, in that part of the world, the nomadic tribes do not create a very well-populated area. But what happened was a kind of Saudification, because it's possible to, as we read in anthropological texts, for example, it's possible to change tribal allegiance. And after all, Saudi is the name of tribal allegiance, since it's a tribe of Saud. So from that point of view, there was a kind of Saudification. On the other hand, it's also true that in the east of Saudi Arabia, the most oil-rich parts, you have Shia Muslims, not Sunni Muslims. And their Saudi allegiance is considered sometimes a little doubtful, but at the same time, they're in the oily parts of the country. So, so one closes one's eyes a little, too.
Well, what about this, if I can ask one more on the same train of thought. In the documentary Death of a Princess, one of the people makes a statement about the influence and continuance of tribal culture getting involved in all this, so that you have not only the original Muslim influence and then the Turkish overlay, but also tribal customs and mores. How much truth is there in that?
I think what Douglas was talking about in terms of the legal system, one sees this most of all, although this will be vigorously denied because the Islamic code is a well-known, established code of law. But the institutions of, you know, the cutting off the hand, flagellation of women, this, that, you walk into the souks, and I was being taken by a Pakistani woman, And we were walking in, and we were sort of careful because obviously we were not Saudis. People were looking at us. I was dressed in this odd way. And suddenly she says, look, you know, we're in a very dark place, and it's not sunlight that you see at the end of the tunnel, but take a look. What is it? And really, there was this absolutely blazing, in a narrow lane, and this blazing something or the other. I said, I don't know. She says, gold. You know, and in the gold shops, gold is just hanging free. No one will touch it because, of course, their hands will be cut off. So that, I mean, one really sees that kind of unquestioned authority of an unwritten law that one associates with what one has read about tribal customs.
Did you ever see anybody with their hands cut off?
No.
Evidently, there's quite a few, and that literally hundreds of people are going around with one hand. And the only taboo against this is you can't eat with your friends, because Muslims eat with one hand and use other hands for certain other bodily functions. And they cut off the hand with which you eat with,
so that people with the bad hand left.
So they're not allowed to eat in public, but nonetheless, people are not, they're not looked down upon, or it's not a stigma otherwise, except for that one custom. The story that I had was that Saud was able to enforce this rigorous sort of half-tribal and half-Islamic law, and he was able pretty much to eliminate crime, to eliminate the tribes that were robbers, basically, because he would literally cut their hands off, or worse. And this actually helped pacify the country and homogenize it, and that this aided a lot of tribes who weren't subject to prey by warriors.
That's right.
As well as the pilgrims who could travel to Mecca without the fear that they had before. And this was able to consolidate the absolutistic power of the monarch.
So it was really a progressive force there for
to some extent. And it was one that got support of the people.
Yes, there was no extermination because you were not a Saudis. And within that framework, it was progressive. You see, for people like me, I just have to remember that all of this was going on while the situation of women was like the situation of animals. So, I mean, I can't take progress that seriously. I mean, I don't care if there are thieves, but I do care if the normal woman is treated like an animal.
The other point to be made is that the political system is one of absolutism that's hard for us to imagine. Even the English kings, the monarchs, there was often a parliament that they operated in conjunction with, or there were court intrigues, or there was some division of power between ministers or advisors or priests. There's none of this, is there, in Islam. Isn't it almost absolute political power in the hands of the Saudi king and his royal family?
Certainly it looks like that to an outsider. I guess there must be intrigues. I think that one cannot rule out anywhere. Mm. But it seems to me, you know, the argument that they made was, and, you know, I was reading just everything on Saudi Arabia before I went. So, in fact, I actually, in the first time in my life, bought a copy of Reader's Digest because it had an article on Saudi Arabia, and it was suggested there, following the Saudis, that their custom of majlis, which is where people come in to talk to the king, was very democratic, so grassroots democracy. But certainly it did not seem as if too much discussion was going on. I've seen this on television, you know, sort of people walking in with their elaborate bows and so on, and a few words exchanged, and then elaborate bows and so on. A very stylized situation. Did not look like people coming in and speaking to a kind of royal ombudsman. There was that, and then the other thing that they said was, okay, we will try to reshuffle the power base, you know, because there was public criticism, Western criticism, of what was going on. While I was there, this reshuffling took place, and most of the reshuffling was a changeover in the princes who were in control of various posts. You see, all of the post holders are obviously princes.
And it's within the royal family.
It's within the royal family. So there was a changeover, and some of the young ones got in. And if one looks at the persons who get in, quite often, although not invariably, the person is the son of King Abdulaziz, as he's called, Ibn Saud, Abdulaziz's favorite wife. So there is even that within the
the power structure.
Within the power structure.
Patrick, what about the media situation? You mentioned that you watched television there. What do you see on television?
I watch television, in fact, a lot, because much more than I do here, because I couldn't get out of my room. So I was eating room service, and I was watching television while I was eating. And you can see, of course, canned American TV almost all day. So you can see Kojak and everything.
Oh, there is that.
Yes, everything. But and movies, all kinds of stuff.
Are they dubbed, or they're in English, or
they're in English. They're in English. And you can see sort of Egyptian soap, you know, which is in Arabic, of course, from Cairo. But I kept to Riyadh because I wanted to see what was going on. Most of the time, I mean, there were sort of very corny and stilted kind of desert plays where, of course, you couldn't see the women's faces. And heaven knows, we are so used to women's bodies and faces being the stuff that sells in these kinds of corny things, that when you can't see a woman's body or face, it seems singularly lacking in interest. And the men are not wearing tight jeans either, you know, so that I mean, nothing's going on. Then they're showing prayers all the time, you know, the Kaaba in Mecca and the prayers going up and the prayers in Urdu. And then you see news. I always watched the English news. In the English news, you get cuts from American, English, etc., little bits about the election campaign and games. But when you come to Saudi Arabia, it is all censored out so that you see their lips moving. First of all, there are no human interest stories or local news or anything. Yeah. The only stories are who came to visit the king.
So he has a monopoly of news power, cultural power.
Who came to visit the king and which princes, His Excellency Prince Taram, His Excellency Prince, and Deputy Minister of this and that, which princes went to receive this dignitary. Then they come into the palace, they sit down, they take tea, and they begin to talk, and you see their lips moving and martial music plays. So that you never hear what's going on. It was really bizarre. Hmm. And they are so beautiful, these men, you know. Even if they're corpulent, it doesn't show because they're wearing these robes. And there are these exquisite Persian miniature faces and the slow movement and no sound at all and just the lips moving and music in the background. I mean, you don't even think it's news.
One wonders how the people are processing this. Do they see their leaders as sort of religious or quasi-divine figures just because they appear on television, or is it just leave them indifferent and bored? It would be hard to know this.
Again, I can't speak for the people. Mm-hmm. Limited by, and you know, academics are always
anti-TV.
But also more ironic against the ruling classes than your man in the street. Right. But it seemed to me that there was a degree of, dissatisfaction, contempt, all of this about the ruling family, not very clearly expressed. And again, I should say that this is only my opinion, but I felt very strongly, I was trying to relate my experience to my travels. I was in Spain in 1962, and it was a lot like the way the Catalans spoke about Franco, you know, and they wouldn't use Franco's name because they were afraid. They would say Simo, you know, which was Generalissimo, you see. Or they would have all kinds of names. And it seemed to me that there was that sort of feeling that one doesn't say too much. But at the same time, there was this sort of impatience, critique, despair, because your hands are absolutely tied when you have an absolute dynastic monarchy and religion and politics identified. You can't do anything like this small thing of changing the face of women's education.
What about radio? Radio can go a long way. Were there any much radio listening by the people or by yourself to pick up either things like Voice of America, Shortwave, or AM?
A lot of music. Mm. A lot of music. And there are Voice of America programs of that ilk that you do here, but really nothing. I didn't listen to as much radio as I watched TV, but it didn't seem to me that it was a situation where it would be a really subversive force for change.
And the people you taught and associated with didn't mention radio as
No, it was much more television. You see, there is also a feeling of, there is a kind of feeling that American television is a wonderful thing. And what they understand as American television are these soaps and these shows, you know, I don't even know what you call them. So what are they?
Action adventure shows.
You see, those kinds of things. So that they were not, in fact, very educated in television watching. They had these Betamaxes at home because, of course, movie theaters are illegal, so there are no theaters or movie theaters.
So they watch tapes of American movies.
Yes, but you see, they're very disappointing movies, just sort of this mainline tearjerkers or, you know, those kinds of things.
Now, Egypt has been at the forefront of motion picture making in the Arab world for years. You see them all over in Morocco and everywhere.
It's the largest film industry in the world in Egypt.
It is.
India, and then Egypt.
Right.
Yes. I apologize.
So you're saying then that even this Egyptian penetration has not reached Saudi Arabia?
No, I mean, when I said they watched Egyptian soap, that's what I sort of meant. I mean, there is Egyptian pulp, Indian pulp, you know, even Indian pulp, you know, that kind of stuff, which is the largest film industry. Yes, you do see that. Mm-hmm. That's quite true.
Gayatri, what about the stability of the regime? You mentioned that you thought there was a cynical, critical, in a sense, attitude towards the Saudi family and a certain discontent. What political forms does that take? There were rumors that the Mecca occupation of the mosque that we saw on television this last fall was really political dissidents, guest workers, certain political radicals, etc. What stories have you heard about who really occupied the mosque in Mecca and what really happened there? And does this indicate there's some sort of discontent or political opposition to the main government?
Stories that I have heard in America and accounts that I have read in journals written in English have emphasized the political aspect of the takeover, abortive takeover. But it's being explained away. It was much discussed by many people, sometimes even brought up as a topic of discussion. It's being explained away in terms of the move towards Islamic fundamentalism that is taking place among university-educated young people following the lead of Iran. This is the regular explanation given, that is what it was, and if that sort of thing succeeds, we will be even worse off because we already have a very puritanical Islamic regime. If on top of this demands for greater purity are made, these young people don't know what that can lead to and how long it took the other Islamic countries to gain modernization and the light of reason from the West, taking us back.
This sounds like the westernizing type of Arab that makes this sort of argument, that identifies themselves and their regime with modernity and a fundamentalist Islamic regime with sort of barbarism.
Yes.
That's a bit suspicious.
Of course it's suspicious. Yeah. What was happening there is what, if I can bring Derrida's name in for a moment, he has called it a kind of oneric logic, like, you know, in a dream, you use that strange kind of logic, you know, where you say, I didn't borrow the kettle was broken anyway, and, you know, when I returned it, it was good as new. Obviously, these three things don't work together, but in a dream, you can use logic like this.
And that's the form of thinking.
So at the same time that, the wife of a faculty member or a faculty member himself is saying, this is, the pure Islam is much more democratic than Western systems of democracy, he or she is saying, these kids who took Mecca, you know, it was an unimportant thing, but these kids who took Mecca don't understand that if you go back to pure Islam, it's going to mean the end of every democratic impulse, you know.
Well, apparently the people in the American power structure are more concerned about the stability in this part of the world, and particularly the Saudi Arabian country. They continually say in the small print that this is basically what they're concerned about and why they have troops stationed there. They're really not primarily concerned about the Soviet Union. They know that's a bunch of hogwash. But they are concerned about indigenous movements that can topple any of these governments.
And it's because, obviously, the oil, which brings up the question we really haven't gotten into yet, is what is the role of oil and OPEC and the multinationals there? Obviously, it's hard to know to see this from inside if you're coming in as a tourist. Mm-hmm. But what forms does this take that are visible? How do people discuss the roles of the multinationals? Evidently, the Saudi family owns all the oil there. But yet, they have some relationships with OPEC, and there's all sorts of interconnections there. Is this talked about at all? Or is this manifest in any way in Saudi Arabia?
I think I'll tell you a couple of stories rather than attempt a really reasoned answer to this, because after all, this is such a difficult field. The first way in which it hit my consciousness was when I was being taken out to dinner by the head of the English department, and he stopped to get some gas, 21 cents a gallon. Mm. Okay, first of all, that. Secondly, they sell gas in Riyadh, and I don't even know how they do it outside, but in Riyadh, you know, just anyone can set up. There's no brand name or anything, just three little pumps, you know, you're just buying it like you buy sugar or starch over the counter in India. You know, it's just a thing. But people don't talk about OPEC a lot at all. What they do talk about, and this is my second story, by happenstance, I was the only woman present at a luncheon where the managing director of Saudi Arabian Diesel, the governor of the electricity board, the dean of something or the other, a cabinet minister without portfolio, the president of Duke University, and the head of the Middle Eastern Center at Duke were present. And I was there sort of, you know, being the woman since I was in that hotel. And they were talking about oil in a very self-conscious way, especially since there were two American guests present who had come to ask for money. And they were really saying quite openly that they felt that the American attitude towards Saudi Arabia was something that should be more should be analyzed more in a world context, because it was, and they were referring to the fact that Saudi Arabia has kept the price of oil down with the OPEC countries, etc., etc. They were saying that we are not paid back enough for our attempt with the, I mean, exactly the line that I read in Reader's Digest, you see, that we help America by keeping the price down, etc., and America does not recognize what we are doing. They were extremely irritated about Abscam. And they said, the thing that we really mind is that you use our name in this kind of a thing. And then how would you like it if we suddenly launched a program like that called Juice Scam? Would you like that a lot? How do you think we feel? Etc. On the other hand, the intellectuals...
But that's legal there. That's the way of doing things there.
Well, who would say that? I said absolutely nothing. The most of the teachers, of course, are post-1973 teachers, post the éclatement, the bursting open of this country after the oil prices began to rise. But the few intellectuals at university who got their PhDs before 1973, one of them, in fact, took me aside and gave me this book that I recommend very highly. It's a book by an Englishman, I think, Andrew Duncan is his name. The book is called The Money Rush.
The Money Rush.
The Money Rush, you know, like the Gold Rush. Mm. And this professor of Islamic history said to me, you know, most Saudi men will be very critical of this book, but he lent it to me. And he said, you read it, and I can tell you that you won't be able to put it down. I want it back tomorrow. And it's quite true. I stayed up all night and I read it. And there, I think, the connection between the situation of OPEC and the situation in Saudi Arabia is made abundantly clear. It's a book written on interviews. And the final thing that I will say in terms of this OPEC situation is the way the Saudis are buying education. And
That explains why the Duke University president was there.
Let's talk about the death of a princess.
Yeah, I had a couple questions about that. First of all, why are they so sensitive about their image in the West? And why were they so upset about this? According to a story in the Village Voice, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia came to one of the producers of the PBS station that was going to show it and literally said that the Saudis would consider raising oil prices if the death of a princess was shown, and that military cooperation between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia might be endangered as a result. And according to this Village Voice story, the head of PBS was about to cancel it when the local Boston station leaked to the public that this pressure was coming, and also Mobil Oil put out this this ad attacking it, and it would have looked that like PBS was capitulating to Mobil. So they gritted their teeth and held their breath and showed the thing, and it evoked quite a bit of controversy and discussion about Saudi Arabia. Why were they so concerned about this, the Saudis?
You know, much as I deplore the absolute sexual segregation and the exploitation of women in Saudi Arabia, I understand and perhaps even sympathize with their sensitivity. I think it's a separate issue. I think the sense that America is literally and figuratively in debt to Saudi Arabia and yet can lord it over Saudi Arabia because Saudi Arabia is seen as an uncultured, tribal, uneducated, non-white place. I think the sensitivity that comes out of that is related much more to the general history of white colonialism than to the situation in Saudi Arabia. I think I share that sensitivity. Indians share that sensitivity.
You said that you thought that the death of a princess sort of represented in general the situation of oppressed peoples under colonialism.
Let me try and make myself clear. Okay. What I was trying to say is that the sensitivity of the Saudis about the movie relates to this general sense of how the white colonials cannot ever accept our point of view, etc.
The whole sort of racist perception of the white man's burden.
That's right.
That colonialized people are inferior and that they therefore don't want to perpetuate this self-image and that they felt. Well, what actual distortions do you think were in that that could justifiably give them cause for grief?
Well, you know, I didn't feel that there was distortions that could give them cause for grief, so that at the same time, as I understand why they would react that way, I'm not saying that they're right in reacting that way in the case of this movie. Mm-hmm. See what I mean? I felt, in fact, that the problem with the movie was that it was too Western in the sense of taking the value of romantic love, etc., as the central point around which to organize the critique. And I felt like saying, what else is new? That's a value.
This raises a question. The Saudi critique of the movie was that it misrepresented the sexuality of the royal family, that they weren't this promiscuous. And interestingly, in the panel discussion after they played the film on PBS, someone raised the question, do the Saudi princesses go cruising in the deserts and pick up men? And the people on the panel said, no, of course they don't. And yet you had a different story of an experience you had in Saudi Arabia. What do you think the sexuality actually is of the Saudi family? And did the movie rather accurately portray it?
Well, everything that I say, of course, I did not participate in anything with the royal family except go to one reception organized by the Princess Sarah, who's a very philanthropic person. And there I saw a few of the princesses who were at the same party, and they talked to each other. They were extremely well-dressed in a slightly garish way and seemed to have no conversation at all. But certainly there were no drinks there or anything. At the same time, it is well known that when the women, in fact, celebrate marriages, etc., and they're by themselves, that they are extremely, quote, licentious, unquote. And this notion of the women cruising is also something that one hears about. And the notion of there being a real drug problem and a real alcoholism problem among the princesses is also heard about. And that I didn't hear from non-Saudis. I heard from Saudis, all kinds of Saudis. So I would say that it probably is not a misrepresentation.
Do you think, is it just gossip from
people from the underlings who would naturally gossip about the goings-on in the court? Or do you think there is some real...
It's conceivable that it's gossip. That's the kind of thing I was trying to say when we were talking about the true religion. One has to ask, why do people say this? My real point, though, was this is not the thing to choose to focus on if one is going to make a critique of the woman's condition in Saudi Arabia, whether the princesses are picking up men or not. Because, you know, a strong-minded woman could very easily ask the question, oh, what's so funny about picking up men? It's okay. But the real question is, what happens to women who are not princesses? What happens to women who are middle class or women who are poor? And what happens if we decide that the only freedom that worth thinking about is the freedom to have romantic sex? You see what I mean? That's the reason why I felt troubled about the movie. I think it's possible to make a strong, attractive, critical movie which doesn't take that kind of a stale Western ideological grid and the problems of an upper-class woman seen from this point of view to talk about a situation which is a very important phenomenon in today's world. And that was my problem with the movie.
I see. Well, when are you going back to Saudi Arabia?
I hope next year.
Really?
I hope next year.
To live the same life and do the similar things?
Yes, I don't think I would last very long, but the rector of the university, a very charming man, asked me if I would like to come back, and I then told him that it was too soon for me to say anything. But since then, I've thought about it a lot, and I have written back saying I'd like to go back.
That's the end of this Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We also can give you information on how to get material which has been originated by former CIA officer John Stockwell. We'd like to thank our crew for our program. Eric Eubank was our camera person, and Kevin L. West was our audio man. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. So that's our address in case you'd like to write to us. A lot of people do, in fact, a whole lot of people do, which sometimes presents a bit of a problem because we don't have a staff to handle all of it, so sometimes it takes a little while to answer it. But we will get around to it, even though it may take a little while. And we really enjoy hearing from you. That's the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. Bye.